June 25th, 2003. Dear Miss Parton, my name is Marston Mottweiler. I'm a deputy sheriff assigned to investigations with the Inyo County Sheriff's Department in California. I have been assigned to investigation of human remains discovered in the Panamint Dunes area of the Panamint Valley near Death Valley, California. The remains, which are only bones, were discovered on February 15, 2003, by hikers in this remote area of the desert. The age and physical description of Nuri Alexander are consistent with the found person. Based on the circumstances, I believe there is a possibility the remains found in Panamint Valley could be your daughter. I'm sure this is distressing, but hopefully it will lead to answered questions and closure for you. Sincerely, Marston Mottweiler.
This is Trickster, The Many Lives of Carlos Castaneda, Chapter 9, Exit Paradise.
Weird that you contacted me now, because I was in California visiting my sister and we were like talking and stuff and talking about people in our hometown, and then Patty came up.
This is Norma Mulligan, a childhood friend of Patricia Parton.
My sister, she was like, do you remember when I sent you the article about the five women, the witches? She goes, I have it right here. I started reading it, and it was just making me so sad. It was just too much. How could I even know someone who this happened to? It's just surreal.
I typed in her name on Google.
Wendy Blake learned about Patricia Parton's death when one day she attempted to find out what had ever happened to her high school best friend after they had lost touch.
I was just devastated, and I couldn't believe it. And I told a couple other friends about it, and, you know, everyone was just in shock.
Childhood friend, Cherie Thompson Smith.
I remember looking it up online thinking, oh my God, I went to high school with this girl. This is insane.
I even had dreams after I found that out. You know, dreams like she really was alive and they didn't find her bones and she all of a sudden came back and we were so happy.
And I remember our childhood of riding bikes around town and playing at each other's house. I remember one photograph that my mom had taken. It was all of us girls on the front of her house, just laughing hysterically and kind of rolling around on the grass.
I remember her happiness and her light and just how a tragic thing happened to her, and that it just kept getting worse and worse and just snowballed to the end.
That tragic thing Norma is referring to wasn't what happened to Patricia Parton in Death Valley. It was something that had happened when Patricia was still just a kid. To tell this story, we'll start at the beginning with Patricia Parton's parents, Joyce and Buck. Dreamers of the Golden Dream, both were Midwestern transplants who had moved out west in search of the future. They met in California and settled in Laverne, a tiny town nestled in a sea of orange groves. In its pre-World War II heyday, Laverne had once been the capital of California's citrus empire, an inland Eden that Route 66 snaked through on its way to Los Angeles. Laverne had seemed to Joyce and Buck like a good place to raise a family. Cherie Thompson Smith.
My kids make fun of me and they always say, oh yeah, you grew up in Mayberry. But it was. It seemed like it was such an innocent time.
I always thought of them as a super unusually close family.
Kathleen Bueller, one of Patricia Parton's first best friends.
It was kind of like a estrogen-filled household with all those girls. There were five daughters, and Patty was the second from the youngest.
Cherie Thompson Smith.
She was a really sweet girl. She was the skinniest little thing with long, pin-straight dark hair.
Norma Mulligan.
She was a normal, sweet little girl. Face of an angel, really beautiful girl. I think Patty took after her mom quite a bit because her mom was more on the quiet side. And Patty was also a little on the quiet side too. And she was one of those type of people until you really got to know her, and then she would be herself.
Cherie Thompson Smith.
The girls were really close to their dad. He was a very outgoing personality. He was a hard worker. And I mean, he was the whole foundation of the family.
Norma Mulligan.
He was always in the garage, like at his workbench, fiddling with the camper and all that mechanical stuff. And just always smiley, always happy, just vivacious. You could tell Patty was Daddy's little girl. It was just a real loving relationship.
Every year, the Partons would spend vacation breaks on camping trips. Patty's father would load up the camper, and the family would hit the road. One trip to Joshua Tree National Park would prove fateful. On that trip, out on a dried-out lake bed, Patty and her family had gathered to watch Buck race his motorbike with a family friend. Stories differ about the details of what exactly happened next. In one version, Buck and his friend were playing chicken. In another, they were chasing each other in loops. At some point, while racing, the two motorbikes collided, catapulting Buck into the air. Word of the fall soon spread back in Laverne.
I remember us finding out about the accident. You know how news trickles in a small town.
Norma Mulligan.
And going over there and her telling us and everything. And I remember her just being really upset and crying. And it was awful. It was horrible. It was sad. Her dad ended up surviving it, but he was not the same. He had brain injury and really incapacitated, you know, in the wheelchair. He was like a shell of a person of what he used to be. He didn't look the same, and you could see the damage that was done on his head, and his life was gone.
Before long, Patty's older sisters had all graduated and moved out, leaving behind just Patty, her mom, and her younger sister.
It was like their family just broke. It just broke her mom down so bad. And I could see it on Patty, too. She just went downhill. Just too much. It just seems like Patty almost deteriorated with him. We would go over and try to get her to go with us to the movies or go out, go to a party or whatever. And she'd be like all bundled up in sweaters with a hot cup of tea. It wasn't the same. She wasn't the same.
Sheree Thompson-Smith.
She's totally different, 100% different. She just seemed like she didn't belong anymore, kind of like invisible, like a very sad soul. I don't imagine she felt important when all of this happened. Her mom was consumed with her own grief and inability to handle it.
When Patty began high school at Benita High in the early 70s, she started hanging out with a new group of friends, a crew of misfit outsiders. The group hung out in one of the last remaining groves in the former citrus empire of Laverne. It was located just across the street from the school. And it was there, under cover of citrus leaves and over carpets of cigarette butts, that concert adventures were fabled, joints bogarted, and battered paperbacks swapped. One of those paperbacks was The Teachings of Don Juan. The book's reports from non-ordinary reality were of a natural interest to Patty.
She was always trying to leave her mind.
Patty's friend, Wendy Blake.
I remember we were in my bedroom and she said, Wendy, do you want to leave your body? Once you're out of your body, you can go anywhere you want to go. And I'm like, wow. And I said, sure. But I never did. But I think maybe she might have thought she did.
Patty's desire to leave not just her body, but Laverne and the life she was living there began expressing itself in her dreams for the future.
She wanted to be somebody. She wanted to be an actress. Her favorite actress was Greta Garbo. That was who she loved, was Greta Garbo. She knew she was beautiful, and she would dress up like her and kind of mimic her. She was a drama queen. She liked to act out, and we'd dress up in old dresses that had padded shoulders on them and walk downtown with old lady purses and stuff. We did stuff like that.
Patty and her friends also did other stuff. Patty's friend, Claire Neff.
Her house was a good place to go because her mom was always out of it.
I don't know if she drank before the dad got hurt, but she, like, drank a lot afterward.
She was passed out all the time. We'd find her in the backyard or in the bathroom. And their older sisters were gone. They had already moved. So it was Patty was running the show, and so, hey, we could go over there and ditch, we could go over there and take acid, we could get drunk, we could smoke pot, get drunk and take acid, you know, it didn't matter.
On rare occasions, Patty's friends would get brief glimpses into the dark, swirling torment of her inner world.
We were in her room, in her house, and then for some reason we went outside, and all I remember is she was went into the middle of the street, standing there with her arms a little bit out and her head leaning all the way back, and starts screaming, why, just crying about why did this have to happen to her dad?
You never knew what kind of mood she was going to be in. You never knew if she was going to let you in or not come to the door at all, or come to the door and tell you she doesn't want to hang out today and just close the door in your face. I mean, she was that kind. And then the evil, I think she would take out on her mother. Like, she would drink her mother's booze and take her car whenever she wanted and take her money. If she needed money, she didn't give a shit. Just go take it out of her mom first.
And then one day, Patty was gone.
I just remember her just leaving. She left Laverne. Nothing around Laverne was good enough. None of the high school stuff or none of the hometown stuff was good enough. Hollywood was the whole enticement of just being something, just being somebody.
Sheree Thompson-Smith.
She was always looking for something.
Wendy Blake.
I know that she was just looking for something to make her happy. And I don't think she ever found it.
Around the same time Patty was headed for Los Angeles, Castaneda was beginning a new phase of his own. Having been kicked out of the heavenly kingdom of UCLA, and with little chance of landing a professorship elsewhere, Castaneda had begun running his own private university of sorcery. He had purchased Spanish-style apartment units off Pandora Avenue in Westwood Village, not far from UCLA. At Pandora, Castaneda went so far as to replicate UCLA's tiled pathways. And in the courtyard, he planted a small orchard of citrus trees. The grounds of Castaneda's campus would be a magical garden. Now, he just needed to complete the formation of his inner circle. Finding willing candidates had never been a problem. Since the release of the teachings of Don Juan, Castaneda had always had to deal with scores of students flocking to him in search of guidance and answers. One-time friend David Walachinsky.
My wife Flora and I went to this library fundraiser in downtown Los Angeles because Carlos had said to us, why don't you come? We can spend an evening together. So we showed up early. The Mexican band was just setting up. And there was Carlos with Anne-Marie. And eventually other people came to join the four of us at the same table because Carlos had invited them. And they appeared to me to be students from UCLA. At one point, Carlos winked at me, like, watch this. And then he started in a very serious voice, telling these innocent, celebrity-struck students that one of the band members in this Mexican band, and Carlos pointed him out, was really secretly a very important brujo. And they were nodding and looking over at the guy, and they were just kind of in awe. Then Carlos turned to me and gave me another wink. Like, got him, didn't I?
A projected story could transform the ordinary into the special. While many students sought to receive Castaneda's tutelage, he was selective about who he would work with. Castaneda biographer Roberta Marshall.
Castaneda played the role of a teacher with a lot of different people on a lot of different levels. A bunch of people who knew Carlos would use the metaphor of the onion for all the different layers that surrounded him. And for people who were on the outside of the onion, he would just kind of pop into their lives unpredictably and give them sometimes very helpful practical advice and spiritual advice and sometimes give them exercise.
One student on this level was Celeste Freeman, who in the early 70s, while working at 17 Magazine, against all odds, landed an interview with the elusive author. But when they met, the interviewer-interviewee dynamic soon changed into something else. Celeste Freeman.
He was this magical uncle, and he sort of adopted me. Once we just began, I didn't really know what I was doing. So, I mean, I knew that at some point there had to be a story for 17. But he seemed to want to take me through different experiences, and so I went along with that. You know, we'd go walk around the beach, we'd go to movies because he'd decide I needed to see a certain movie. I mean, he took me to the film, The Anti-Mame.
Now, here you've been taking my dictation for weeks and you don't get the message of my book. Live, that's the message.
Afterwards, we came out of the theater and he said, I took you to this movie because I want you to know that you must use the world, but you must remember to use it with love. And another time, he gave me this ochre-colored rock that he said Don Juan gave to him to give to me, and that I should polish it And I polished it and polished it and polished it until I was emotionally exhausted and ready to pass out. I don't remember what the reason was behind it, what it was going to do, but it never occurred to me not to do any of things. He told me how to run in the dark and not tumble and go ass over teacup, trusting instincts, that sort of thing. But he instructed me in a way that worked. And you know, I never felt he was asking me for anything. There was no imposition. I feel like I got only gifts from him. He was life-changing in the best possible way.
Another student Castaneda worked with in the 70s was Debbie Good, who also happened to be one of Garfinkel's students.
I remember I had these meetings with him in Westwood, just south of the campus. There's one place we went to. And
I remember this
one time. He talked to me about thumbs for an hour.
He asked me to put my thumbs in my palms for the next 2 days. And I said, okay, I'll try that. It was just simple mindfulness. So I understood that.
I found his instructions useful. He never did anything to me, nothing that I could even vaguely even think was bad. It was all good, entirely. I'm nobody. He does these things for me, and he meets with me. He was like he was, how sweet. I don't think I was a major player in Castaneda's life because he had a little coven of practitioners, and I wasn't part of the special group.
The next level up for students of Castaneda required a much greater degree of commitment to their training. Castaneda biographer Roberta Marshall.
Other students of Castaneda's were brought in closer to the center of the onion. They'd be urged to take new names and ritually destroy photographs and other kinds of traces from their past and to break off ties to their families. Over time, more and more of these kind of students ended up living in apartments near Castaneda that he would pay for. It was kind of his own little kingdom out on the outskirts of UCLA.
Unlike the lower levels, which were gender independent, Castaneda's inner circle was comprised only of women, a sex he had some rather unorthodox views about. David Walachinsky.
He said that he was opposed to women's liberation. He said that women already controlled the world. Men thought they were potent, but they were really subservient to women. And women were just smarter and could control things while not appearing to be doing so. And he said that he was raised as a child. He was raised to be henpecked.
While a large candidate pool of students always existed, the task of finding members who were the right fit for his innermost circle didn't always prove easy for Castaneda. One woman who he had unsuccessfully tried to recruit was Joellen Archambault, a member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and now the director of the Native American program at the Smithsonian Institute. Before meeting Castaneda in person, Joellen had met Castaneda in the teachings of Don Juan, and that meeting had been awkward. Joellen Archambault.
Somebody gave it to me and said, here, you should read this and tell us what you think about it. So I read it, and I literally thought it was crap. And I thought, this guy's a con artist. He's here to spread the wisdom of the Indian elders. And he's a real Indian traditions. Blah. I mean, I've been in the Indian world off and on my entire life, and so I know what happens in religious experiences or a vision quest. I've experienced all of that kind of stuff. And this isn't like any Indian religion I've ever heard about or experienced. And let's see if he even has field notes. And if there are field notes and they're legit, then I'd have to rethink all of this. I think I was pretty cynical at that point.
It turned out that a good friend of Joellen's was attending a guest seminar that Castaneda was teaching in the spring of 1972 at UC Irvine. Joellen decided to come down to Irvine to see if she could meet Castaneda and possibly get her hands on his field notes. Her friend made arrangements with Castaneda for them all to go out to lunch. Joellen had heard certain rumors about Castaneda and went with her guard up.
Castaneda was really interested in young women, and I was very cautious and very suspicious.
At lunch, Castaneda told the two friends that Don Juan had told him that four special women were needed to help Castaneda in an upcoming battle against an ally, a powerful entity in the world of sorcery. The band of women were to be called
the Winds.
There were to be four, one for each of the cardinal directions. Later, Castaneda told Joellen and her friend that Don Juan had approved them to officially become Winds, but they would need to go through an initiation ritual to enhance their soceric powers.
He wanted sex, and I was saying to myself, hell, you're getting any sex from me. I mean, I have 12 years of Catholic school behind me. Oh, my God. But I think my friend, she was sexually a lot more adventurous than I was.
But it turns out, Jo Allen's friend wasn't fated to be a wind either. In addition to the ritual intercourse, there was also another string attached. Castaneda told Jo Allen's friend that she would have to get rid of the dog that she owned. She told him that she would. But when Castaneda arrived at her place for the ritual initiation, from behind a closed door, he heard a dog bark. He took off. Later, Castaneda would share a slightly altered account of these events with his old UCLA classmate, Donald Brown.
I was walking in the UCLA library, and he was coming out of it. And we stopped on the stairs and talked. That's when he told me about his experience teaching to a class at UC Irvine. Two women in the class who sat near the front and very definitely caught his attention because they came with a big black dog. And at one point, he was in his office, and these two women came with their big black dog, and he said he was really frightened just by the sight of them, and especially by that dog. But he went on to visit them, and it turned out that that dog was the devil, and it just scared the living daylights out of Carlos. And these women had sex with that dog. Well, of course, this really caught my attention. And I laughed a lot about it because I didn't know what to make of it. But then that story showed up in the next book he published.
Over time, the Winds would eventually evolve into the Witches. As members of Castaneda's inner circle, they were expected to be able to assume entirely different identities. Don Juan, Castaneda said, had once assigned him a new identity. Castaneda's editor at Simon & Schuster, Michael Korda.
There's a period at which Don Juan made Carlos take a job as a short order cook in a truck stop in Arizona. It was something he had to go through and stick it out, which of course Carlos did. As I understood it, slipping into the role of an illegal immigrant Mexican. And like any big truck stop, you start cooking around 4:30 in the morning, cooking at one time 30, 40 orders of eggs and having to get them right, because if there's one thing there are people fussy about is that, you know, people will accept all sorts of crap, but the way they want their eggs is the way they want their eggs to be. Guy who's employing him said, they're telling you right now, you can't fuck up. You fuck up the eggs, you're out. And so Carlos learned. And Carlos, I remember he said, because I always thought it was a wonderful phrase, he said, you have to know egg. And I've never forgotten the phrase, you have to know egg. Because you do. You know, you've got like 30 orders coming in at one moment, and each one of them is going to be different. Scrambled eggs, soft, fried easy over, two poached, runny yolks. You know, you've got 100 eggs cooking at the same time, and each person has a different idea of how their eggs should come out. So you can't fuck up. You have to know egg.
Being able to inhabit a different identity was a way to deflate one's overly aggrandized sense of self-importance, and in the process, free up latent energy.
I saw Juan later. I didn't see him for nearly 3 years. And after the book was published, I paid him a visit because I wanted to show him the book, because I had told him that I was going to write one. So I went to Central Mexico. I took the book and I showed it to him, and he looked at it, he flipped the pages, and then I got a surge of pride and I said, I want you to have it. And the one says, I better not. You know what we do with paper in Mexico? That was his opinion of the book. I thought it was great. I thought it was a lovely touch. The one's been telling me this for years. The idea that I have to lose importance.
The energy unleashed from identity switching was of critical importance to the central project being undertaken at Castaneda's school. Castaneda's friend, Larry Watson.
I remember him telling me when we were taking a walk along the cliffs in Santa Monica, you know, one day this little brown body, and he would point to himself, is going to die. And I said, well, yeah, I guess that's the fate of all of us. He said, but I don't want to die. And I think Don Juan can help me to cheat death or to beat death. And I said, well, people throughout the ages have tried various strategies to do that, and I don't know how it's going to work for you. But he said, I've dropped hints in some of my books as to how people. They have the right mental discipline. They can almost will themselves into a different plane of being and experience. And by doing that, they can transcend these earthly confines that we all seem to think are just immutable, that they can never be changed. And I said, but maybe that's an illusion, though. He wasn't going to give up on this, and he was convinced that if he stayed the course, he would actually not experience a physical death, but would experience a kind of immortality.
Where he could just keep on carrying on, you know, an eternal heaven. As he grew older, as this became an increasing obsession with him, he wanted to be able to reassemble himself with these followers, and they were evidently all agreed that this was a worthwhile mission for them to undertake.
But before Castaneda and his group of followers could depart, they would have to find a new Nahual to perpetuate the ancient Toltec lineage and preserve the myth, the story that Castaneda had helped bring into being. In his book, The Fire from Within, Castaneda learns from Don Juan that it's sometimes necessary for a Nahual to trick his prospective successor into becoming the next Nahual. And sometimes the trick can take the form of a drama, but not just any kind of drama, a magical drama. Like Shakespeare's Prospero, a Nahual could be both part of the drama and the author of the drama's script. But even more urgent than finding a successor, Castaneda still needed to find the right members to depart with. Up until now, there were two permanent fixtures in his inner circle. One was Regine Thal, a.k.a. Florinda Donner.
I am Florinda Donner. I'm an anthropologist. I've been working with Carlos Castaneda over 20 years. And as a student of anthropology, I was drawn into the world of sorcerers, and I have stayed there ever since. When I encountered the world of Don Juan, there was no chance to be cautious. I either jumped in or there was no game. I cut myself off purposefully from most people that I knew, including my parents, of course. My parents did not know for about 10, 12 years whether I was dead or alive. It was a very calculated move, because from the sorcerer's point of view, is for us to change, for us to be able to change, we need to cut off ourselves from the people that know us so well. Because not that they do it maliciously, but they prevent us from changing, because they already know what we are, and nothing that we do will make them change their mind.
The other mainstay in Castaneda's inner circle was Marianne Simcoe, a.k.a. Taisha Abelar.
We always begin our lectures and interviews by stating our names. My name is Taisha Abelar, and we stated because it is a dream. Sorcerers say that when a person reaches the final stages of dreaming, they are what they dream. And so Taisha Abelar is the dream that I am dreaming. We use many, many different names depending on what our purpose is.
While studying as an undergrad at UCLA, Taisha began being trained by Castaneda in the art of identity switching.
I was in my early 20s when I came into Don Juan's world. From that moment on, every single thing that I have done has been a training, sorcery training. And that includes going to the university. That was a mandate that they gave me, is that you have to cultivate a romance with knowledge. And I had to do the university training, receive a PhD, not from the point of view of the everyday person in the world, the way people usually just go through school.
Larry Watson remembers one rather strange encounter with Taisha.
It was in 66 or 67. I was polishing up my thesis. So I was around a lot, this office in Haynes Hall. One day, there's a knock on the door. I open it. There's this strange-looking young woman. She was quite tall, pretty athletic-looking, very pretty, very exotic-looking. She said, Carlos thought you would be able to direct me. I'm thinking of becoming an anthropology student or something like that, some story. And I said, well, yeah, sure, come on in. I can tell you a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I'm not exactly a professional counselor. But actually, she didn't really want to talk too much about much of anything. She was pretty quiet. I thought we were going to have a long, involved conversation, but it wasn't really very long. She seemed like she did what she was sent to do, and that was it. That she could get up and leave. Very mysterious, the whole thing. I was playing a part in some kind of drama that I didn't understand at all. He sent her on this errand just to sound me out. And how interesting it is that he had that kind of influence on these young women. And they were considerably younger than him. very impressionable, it would seem to me. He could just swamp their consciousness with his charisma, and they would just be willing to do anything that would please him. They were true believers.
To switch one's identity, to erase one's personal history, to cut off all relations with one's family, all of these stringent demands required of members in Castaneda's inner circle amounted to a single tenet: you can't go home again. And yet, Castaneda himself could never stop haunting his own paradises, both those lost and those soon to be. Near the end of Journey to Islam, Castaneda includes a poem by one of his favorite poets, Juan Ramon Jimenez. The poem is called The Definitive Journey. And I will leave, but the birds will stay singing, and my garden will stay with its green tree, with its water well. Many afternoons, the skies will be blue and placid, and the bells in the belfry will chime, as they are chiming this very afternoon. The people who have loved me will pass away, and the town will burst anew every year. But my spirit will always wander nostalgic in the same recondite corner of my flowery garden. A perennial source of ego fertilizer in Castaneda's life, one that he would need to cook a lot of eggs to combat, was the unceasing attention he received from big-name producers and directors in Hollywood and around the world, all of them hoping to secure the film rights to his books. At one point in time, Sterling Siliphant, the Academy Award-winning producer of In the Heat of the Night, did in fact acquire the rights, and he had envisioned radical plans for the project. Siliphant had recently created a production company comprised of young, talented writers and directors who were interested in making low-budget arthouse films tailored to the burgeoning youth culture. Siliphant pictured The Teachings of Don Juan as a 16mm film that would only be distributed in college towns, where he would rent out the theater and then bar admission to anyone older than 23. While The Teachings project never came to fruition, a series of events stemming from its development would greatly impact Castaneda's life. After obtaining the rights, Sterling Siliphant had tapped his nephew Mark Siliphant to write the screenplay for Teachings. After meeting Castaneda, Mark would become one of his students. And it was through Mark that a young girl working at a Denny's in Westwood, a girl named Patricia Parton, would be introduced to Castaneda. In time, Patricia Parton and Castaneda would develop an extremely close relationship. Castaneda had found one more member for his inner circle.
She was completely fanatical to him.
Tony Karam, a student of Castaneda.
He always presented her as if she was something very special.
When Patricia Parton met Carlos Castaneda, she went from being a waitress at a Denny's and a lonely girl still reeling from the breakdown of her family and the tragedy of her father's accident, to being somebody, somebody special. With Castaneda in her life, she can now access rarefied elite worlds. Here's Nathan Gardels, a close friend and advisor to former governor of California, Jerry Brown.
Margarita put together this dinner, and it was just her dark house with candles lit.
Nathan attended a dinner with Jerry, put together by a follower of Castaneda.
And it was Carlos Castaneda and his witches, a young girl that he called his daughter, Nuri, my wife, Lily, Jerry, Oriana Huffington. She was kind of dating Jerry in that period. And then Carlos Fuentes. We talked about everything. The question in those days was, is America imperialist? And Castaneda said, look, I'm a dog of the earth. I come from nowhere. And I'm a professor of anthropology. I'm publishing books. America was a land of opportunity and a great place. Jerry and I saw him and his witches pretty intensively for a few months there because we were hanging around L.A. He was hanging around L.A. Those days I lived in Westwood. So Castaneda and his daughter would come over and Jerry would come and we'd have a potluck dinner. There was a sympathy around the spiritual search.
To become special, Patty had to shift into a new role. She had to become Castaneda's daughter, Nuri Alexander. She had to become a projected story, the Blue Scout, a being from another dimension. To become special, she had to sacrifice her past and all that it consisted of, all the unbearable trauma, but also all those golden moments from long ago, from the time before the fall, when the orchards of Laverne still ran to the arms of the horizon, when she was just an ordinary little girl with a mom named Joyce and a dad named Buck and four sisters. Before cutting off all communication with her family, Patty would briefly see her mom one last time in the late 70s. At that meeting, Patty told her mom that she had begun a new life, and all these incredible things were now happening to her. At one point, her mom asked her if it would be all right if she took a photograph to remember her by. Patty refused. And then just like that, she was again gone. Patty's mom would never again see her daughter. Twenty-five years later, a letter would arrive in Patty's mom's mailbox. It was from a detective out in Death Valley.
Dear Miss Parton, my name is Marston Mottweiler.
Detective Marston Mottweiler was notifying her that her daughter, what was left of her, might have been found. She had been lost since May of 1998, officially that is. But for Patty's mom, it had been much longer than that. Patty had been lost ever since that day she left home with packed bags. Ever since that day when she had gotten into her car and drove down I-10 West, heading for Los Angeles, in search of the magical glory. In the next chapter of our story, we'll hear about how Federico Fellini's long-cherished dream to direct The Teachings of Don Juan ends up sending him off on a series of dark and strange adventures in a world of Castaneda's creation.